And now it is my pleasure to introduce the inaugural speaker of the Southern Cal Speakers Meeting, Ski from San Diego.
My name is Ski and I'm an alcoholic.
Yay!
I like to keep my last name anonymous because it's easier to pronounce. Actually, my last name's Andrashovsky. And when I use it, I get repercussions, like down at the laundry. The girl said, "Why don't you get an American name?" I said, "What's your name?" She says, "Garcia." Had a major in the Marine Corps do that. He says, "Ski, why don't you change your name?" I said, "I'm waiting to see who wins the next war." I don't know why the big hoop-de-doo over it. It's really not that difficult. Heck, I could spell it when I was 16. You notice I'm wearing a hat? The reason I wear a hat is because you never know when somebody's going to do a right about turn and drink like a gentleman. Somebody got to have a hat. I'm going to take it off on it. I don't know when I became an alcoholic, and it's really not important. What's important is that I know that I'm an alcoholic right now. And so I'll go back a bit and tell you how it happened. I don't know when I became an alcoholic. You hear a lot of people say, well, he drank so much that he became an alcoholic. Why did he drink so much? You know, because he was already an alcoholic. Yeah? So we don't know when we become one. Maybe we're born alcoholics. And the symptoms don't come out until you drink a bit. Yeah? That's about the way it works. Anyway, I remember the first time I got drunk. My father was a bootlegger during Prohibition. And he had a big operation going, you know. When everybody else was broke and they were in bread lines and stuff in the Depression, we were touring Europe, you know, on this bootleg money, you know. But I remember we were visiting another bootlegger's house, and they poured my mother a water glass full of wine, and she never drank. So we don't know whether she was ever an alcoholic or not, see. Because she never drank. Symptoms never came out. Yeah? They left the room and they left me with the wine. Now, if I was the type of guy that was going to be a social drinker, I'd have probably tasted it and put it down. But I drank the entire glass. I got drunk and a guy had to take me home. I blew 5 years of sobriety. I remember that like it happened last year, you know. It was a big deal in my life when that happened. Yeah? And I liked the taste of it, and I liked what it did to me. So by the time I was 8, I was getting 2 takes. And my father would give me a shot of his whiskey. I seen a federal agent gauge it. He said, 70% pure alcohol. Which meant that was 140 proof whiskey he was selling there, you know. 140 proof. Now that's enough to make your toothache go away. If you swallowed it, everything went away. And I liked that. So I had a head start on drinking early, you know. And when Roosevelt said go and Prohibition ended, we already had a bar. All we had to do was scrape the paint off the windows and put the license on a wall, and we were in business. And I hung around the bar. I think the first time I attended the bar, I was about 13 years old. My father passed out, and I took over. And by the time I was 15, it was my duty, you know, regular duties. I had to work in the bar. I used to work till 2 o'clock in the morning. We didn't have trouble with the Cleveland Police Department, Cleveland, Ohio. They were all drinking in the back room. I was serving them. Yeah. And I used to work in that bar till 2 o'clock in the morning. Close the bar, hit the sack, and wake up at 7 and go to school at 8. Then sleep through English, you could tell. And that was what I was doing. I was attending bar and going to school. And I knew all the things all the other kids didn't know. I heard all of them at night, you know, in the bar. They would tell jokes, and I used to have to act like I didn't understand them. Yeah? And close the bar at 2 o'clock in the morning, you know, go to school at 8, yeah? I was, I'll give you a little drunkalogue. On Saturday night, while I was standing at the bar, I didn't drink very much. Just every now and then I'd taste something. But on Saturday night, I'd steal a bottle, take it down to the church dance hall, show all my buddies how I could chug-a-lug this stuff. And then I'd go up and do 2 polkas and somebody would take me home. And I give you this little drunkalogue prior to going in the Marine Corps so we don't blame the Marines on my drinking. You know? But at 18, I went into the Marine Corps. World War II hadn't started yet. And I was in about 7 months when Pearl Harbor was bombed. And right after that, I went to the Pacific, joined the 1st Marine Division on Guadalcanal, fell right in with all the boozers. We needed each other even then. We shared our experience, strength, and booze. You know? And it was hard to get good whiskey in the South Pacific. So we do have a resort to other things. We'd all go out and steal all the peaches, cherries, plums, or anything that would ferment, put it in an expeditionary can with a little yeast and sugar. And you let it set for 7 days, and when the little flies appeared, it was done, and we'd drink it. You know? And they called it jungle juice. And I was a member of the Jungle Juice Club. And you could tell who the members were if you went down to the chow line. It was the guys with the black canteen cups. That's what it did to the aluminum. In fact, if you drank this stuff, you got a purple heart. You know, not the metal, a real purple heart. I went through World War II drinking this stuff. And the trouble is, when I really needed it, I couldn't get it. When I needed it was when I was scared. And when they start curling your hair with machine gun fire, it's kind of hard to stop and mix up a batch of jungle juice. You know, and that's when I needed it. And if I couldn't get anything to drink when I was scared, I prayed in that order. And I did a lot of praying in World War II. I remember I got hit a couple of times on Peleliu, and I was aboard a hospital ship, and a chaplain cornered me, and he gave me a Bible to read. And I read that Bible, and read that Bible, and read the Bible like a true alcoholic if it was worth doing, do it too much. And I just got to the point where I started to bless people. And when I got feeling better, and they sent me back to the States and gave me liberty. I remember while I was there, my promise that I made, my higher power, the promise I made when I was in war was, get me out of this alive, I'll become a priest. You know? And then I got well, and they sent me back to the States, and I saw a blonde walk in a dim-lit bar, and I followed her in, and I forgot all about World War II. And all my promises and everything, drank with a little more guilt. And the war ended, and I went back to Cleveland. My father lost the liquor license for doing something illegal, and there were 4 of us veterans in the family. We figured we deserve a liquor license, so we applied. And we had the bar, we just didn't have a license. And they turned us down. So we done the next best thing. We painted the windows, and we had a cheat spot. We were open when all the other bars were closed. In Ohio on Sundays, they only could sell 3.2 beer on Sundays. And we'd be open all through the weekend. You know, night and day, all night. And we were making a lot of money, but I was drinking with everybody we were selling booze to. And I thought, if I keep this up, I'm going to die. And I knew I was drinking too much, and I thought, it's Cleveland's fault. I got too many friends in Cleveland. That's why I drink so much. If I could just get out of Cleveland, I wouldn't drink so much. And I went down to recruiting office, and I reenlisted. And I asked for China. And I asked for China because I didn't have any friends in China. And I figured I wouldn't drink so much. And then again, I thought, in the event I did drink so much, at least the people I hurt would be strangers. Yeah. So I reenlisted, and I asked for China, and they sent me to Quantico, Virginia. And I went through a bunch of stuff there where they thought I was an accountant. They put me in an office. And when they found out I couldn't count, they put me in running a gymnasium and issuing out basketballs and stuff, you know. And I didn't like the job because somebody was doing it all through the war, getting extra money. You know, they were getting extra pay for issuing out basketballs, and I was just shooting at people, and they wouldn't give me nothing, you know. So I had a little resentment already on that. You know, and so I gave away all their equipment while I was there. Yeah. And I said, keep it. Don't bring it back. Yeah. In 3 months, they didn't have any issue to issue out. So had I not been asking for China, I would have got China. But they sent me to Brooklyn. And I spent 3 years dodging people there, you know. When they got to know me, it was time for me to be leaving. And I couldn't get out of Brooklyn. But I moved from one side of Brooklyn to the other. They had different parts of the base. For one period, I was in Long Island, Garden 3, Hungarian Scientist. You know, and I was drunk throughout the whole 4 months I did that. And I ended up getting a commendation out of it. Yeah. And to get out of Brooklyn, I heard they needed somebody to shoot on a rifle team. And I was a pretty good shot. So I put my name down, and sure enough, I made the team, and I got to Quantico shooting in the matches. I shot in the matches with the rifle team, and I fixed it up, so I stayed right there on the rifle range. I didn't go back to Brooklyn. And I got out just before the hatchet fell, and I was in trouble already. And then I was in Brooklyn feeling real safe in Quantico, real safe on the rifle range where nobody knew me. Until we got a new commanding officer, and he came from Brooklyn. And he already knew me, so it's time for me to be going again. And, you know, I always think of this as when I do things my way, you know, my old way of thinking and the way I did things, you know, I always forced my way in there somehow. Snuck around. I was good at evading the things. And here I wanted to get out of Quantico, get away from this new commanding officer, when my enlistment was almost up. And I said, I'll re-enlist if they give me a transfer to Camp Lejeune. I want to get in this outfit that's going to the Med, on a Med cruise for 6 months. If I get on that, I'll be aboard ship most of the time. I won't be able to drink so much. And maybe the trip will be so interesting, I may not want to drink so much. I was always doing things so I wouldn't drink so much. And I put in for this transfer, told them I'd re-enlist if they gave me it, and they turned me down. And I said, they've been giving everybody the transfer up until me, and then it was ended. So I did things my way. I took a discharge, threw all the gear in the back of my car, drove to Camp Lejeune, re-enlisted in the outfit before the discharge was even in effect, you know. And I was back in the Marine Corps. I was back in Lejeune where I wanted to be, in the outfit that's going to the Med. And the Korean War broke out, and we went to Korea instead. Yeah? That's my way of doing things. Yeah? It's really good. Yeah? So I went to Korea, and they started shooting at me again. And I started praying again. Couldn't get anything to drink, so I started praying. I remember the utmost promise I made in Korea was get me out of this alive and I'll become a, I mean, get me out of this alive and I'll get married. Most of my buddies got married and straightened out. And I thought, if I get married, I won't drink so much, you know. So I got married and I kept my promise. But I didn't even slow down drinking. Until my wife got pregnant. My wife got pregnant. I thought, my God, I'm going to be a father. I'm going to have a responsibility. I better do something about my drinking. And I stopped. I quit drinking for 6 months. 6 months I watered the garden 8 hours a day. I couldn't stop drinking. You know? I couldn't stop working. And my son was born. And then I celebrated. And celebrated. And celebrated. And it seemed like every time I'd sober up after that, there'd be another kid sitting at the table. You know? And one day I came to and there were five of them sitting there. And I thought, God, no wonder I drink. I got too much responsibility. You know? And I was still evading people, you know, evading. I was in Japan. And I got on a rifle team and shot my way back to Camp Pendleton. You know, I got on the team and I made it. I got all the way to Pendleton. I remember even then when we were in Japan shooting. We were in Okinawa and we shot our way to Japan and then we shot our way back to the States. But when we were in Japan, my commanding officer called my two buddies and I in and he said, "You guys, your scores are starting to show it. If you don't improve your scores, we're going to drop you from the team." And he says, "I know what's wrong." He said, "You're drinking too much. Don't drink so much. I don't want you to quit. Just don't drink so much." And I didn't know how to do that. The next day, everybody else went out snapping in the afternoon. And I would go down to the bar, you know. And I often wondered how good I could have been if I'd have sober and snapped in like them other guys were doing, you know. But I'd keep up with the team with this way, even, you know. And I was heading for the Air Force Club we had there. And I was thinking, how can I not drink so much? I thought, I know, I'll order a drink I hate. If I drink something I don't like, I won't drink so much. And, you know, I ordered a Bloody Mary with vodka and tomato juice. And after about a dozen, they start tasting pretty good, you know. And I closed the bar the same way, everything the same way. I'd go to my bunk in there, my clothes around the floor. In the morning, I get up, and the houseboy had everything pressed, shoes shined and everything, you know. And we were shooting. That morning was a match between the team. We had about 50 people on the team, and they broke us up into four-man teams. And they gave a cigarette lighter to high shooter for the day. And the two of the guys that were on a high pair and four cigarette lighters to the four guys on the four-man team that won. And that next morning, I was the high shooter in the high pair and the high team. And I won three cigarette lighters, and that major that told me not to drink so much handed out the lighters, and he thought his pep talk really worked, you know. And I was thinking, glory be. I found the shooter's drink, vodka and ammonia and tomato juice. Yeah. Anyway, I shot my way back to the States, and when the matches were over, I stayed in the Pulgas, Camp Pulgas, 7th Marines. And my wife moved up into Wire Mountain, and I'd never be home. I'd be either in the field or I'd be in Oceanside drinking in the King's Room. And it's one day, the way I told this when it happened, I told all my buddies what happened to my car. As I was driving down Hill Street, going from the sandbox to the King's Room, and this idiot in front of me stopped for a yellow light And I ran right into the back end of them, you know. And that sounded like a good reasoning story to tell, so I told that one. But the way it really happened was I was going down a hill street, heading for the King's Room, when I suddenly noticed that my car wasn't moving. And a cop opened the door and I fell out. That's how it happened. And I wound up, they threw me in jail. My captain came out to get me in the morning, and I told him, you know, I'll get you out of jail under one condition. You don't take another drink while you're in my command. And I says, I swear, I'm off. I don't know more, you know. I'm drinking no more. And he got me out of jail. And I still go to the King's Room and see my buddies there. And I was pretty good on the pool table, and I'd have about 15 Pepsis lined up on the pool table. I was drinking Pepsis. And I looked at that, and I thought, I'm going to drown, you know. And I ordered a drink, and I was off and running again. The insurance company fixed my car. It looked like a brand new Studebaker again. And within a week, I ran into Wire Mountain. I lived on Wire Mountain, and I hit the cliff. I ran into a cliff, you know, and smashed the whole front end up again. And I took it back to the same garage, and I told the guy, I don't have insurance anymore. Just hammer it out and make the headlights point to the front. Now I had to sneak the car in and out of the base so the captain wouldn't see it. And, he, you know, if he saw the car, he'd know I'm drinking again, and then I had it. So I wound up, I saw a bunch of people by the bulletin board, and they needed drill instructors, applications for drill instructor school. And I put my name down. I didn't want to be a drill instructor. I was one in Parasana before, you know. That's a rough job, but I put my name down anyway. Because I had to get out of that captain's command. So that's how come I'm in San Diego today. You know, I got transferred to San Diego. And I became a drill instructor. I smashed the car up again on the way, and I was in the right now. The guy hit me in the back end. And I got the money, and I didn't fix the car. I just used that for booze. And so I was driving around in a brand new Studebaker that was all smashed up on both sides. Anyway, that car was the story of my life, you know. Just, you could look at the car and you could know how I lived, you know. And that was the way it went. And I ended up getting another 502. My wife filed for divorce. The finance company took my car, you know, and it all was going bad, and the Marine Corps was starting to look like they're going to kick me out. I got a job moonlighting down in Ocean Beach, so I was drunk all the time. I couldn't stand being sober. And I remember one day I walked into work in the morning. I used to sneak in the back door. I was a gunnery sergeant. I was supposed to be looking for people. I was hiding. I sneak in the back door and sneak over to my desk, and I'd be reading a schedule so nobody could see my eyeballs. And the first thing would happen, they'd say, the captain wants you. And I went over to see the captain. He says, how come you didn't stand your duty this morning? I said, I got the duty Tuesday. He says, today is Tuesday. And I made a gesture. I hit my head, and I said, maybe I ought to go see the talking doctor or something. He said, what time you want to go? I said, where? He says, see the talking doctor. I said, I was kidding. He says, I wasn't. So I had to go see the psychiatrist. I went in there, and one of the first things he says, what's your problem? He says, you drink very much? I says, not any more than anybody else. Picturing my five buddies down at Rex's Cafe. And he said, well, what's your problem? I says, well, it's my wife. She's an unfit mother, and she filed for divorce and took my kids. He wrote that down. He says, that all? I said, no, I got a lot of problems. He says, what? I said, well, She put me in debt, $2,700 in lawyer fees. Squandered all my money on food and stuff. She wrote that down. And I gave him a dozen problems like that that he could work on. And he said, we'll see what we can do about this. And he said, we're going to check on your wife. If she's unfit, we're going to take the kids away. Then we're going to go to Navy Relief and borrow enough money to pay off all your bills. And he went right down the line. He had an answer for every problem. And he got down to the bottom. I says, wait a minute. I said, I need these problems. These are mine, you know. I didn't want to tell him I had another problem, but he knew. Him and the other psychiatrists put their heads together and he come back. He says, you know, we believe you're an alcoholic. The chaplain here has a number of Alcoholics Anonymous, so why don't you give him a call? And the chaplain wrote out the number and I put it in my pocket. And that night I was back down at Rex's Cafe just as drunk as ever. I met my five buddies and I told them what the psychiatrist said, that he thought I was an alcoholic. They said, you're not an alcoholic. You don't drink any more than we do. And I got scared, because I know they were going to do something about my drinking, whether I want it or not. And when I'm scared, I either drank or prayed, and there was a lot to drink there. So I just stayed as drunk as I could. Until the day came when everything went, you know, my wife filed divorce and all of that. Took the kids, the family, and everything went. And I got to the point where I was sitting in a bar in Ocean Beach thinking of suicide. See? I'm going to kill myself. And I knew something was wrong because a year before I was in North Korea in a chosen reservoir shooting at people and freezing 40 below zero and fighting to live, you know? And here I am in a nice warm bar with a good-looking barmaid and a jukebox playing and, you know, all I want to drink, and I'm thinking of suicide. So something ain't going right. And that's when I made up my mind, you know? But what happened was then I went to my barracks and I got my rifle and I was ready to blow my brains out with my beloved rifle. I was going to write a note saying, those who live by the sword, die by the sword. And a corpsman stopped me and took my rifle away. And there's another story there. But it wound up where in the morning he gave me back the rifle. And I remember I knelt down and I says, God, take my life. Croak me if you want to. Do whatever you want with it, but I can't handle it anymore. You just take over. You know, if you want me dead, kill me, you know. And the next day I was in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's how fast it was. I called central office from the Grant Hotel. It was only a block away from the California Theater building then. And I went in a center telephone booth. I looked like I was selling military secrets when I called up AA. And old Howard says, you're a block away. Come on up. And I was nervous as hell, and I said, okay. And I walked over to the California Theater building, went up to the fifth floor. I saw a chicken window door, you know. It said Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thought it should say District Attorney or something, you know. And I'm going to give myself up. And I thought he was going to put me in a rubber room or something, do something like that to keep me from drinking, you know. He gave me a bunch of literature he stuffed in all my pockets, shook my hand vigorously, said, there's a meeting at the Pathfinder, it's seven blocks away, you can make it up on 12th by where City College is now. And pushed me out the door, and I got in the hallway, and I was thinking, why did he let me go? You know? Here I turned myself in, and he let me go. Now I got to do it all over again at another place, you know. So I started walking toward 12th Street. And there's bars all around me. And I was thinking, I'll hit one of these gin mills and join AA tomorrow. But something kept me going. I made it all the way to 12th. I saw the Pathfinder. It was a rickety old building then. And I ran across the street. Made sure nobody saw me. I didn't know anybody in San Diego. And I ran across the street and I ran into the Pathfinder. I got in there. My first words I heard, the guy that became my sponsor was speaking. And he was saying, the difference between a wino and a scotcho is a buck. was my first meeting. And I looked around the room, and everybody there was 60. They looked like 60 anyway. And, I was 36. And I was thinking, well, this is it. It's all over. Ain't no more. From now on, I'll just come here with these old men and whittle away my time and wait to be called up yonder. And my sponsor said, you want to ride back to the barracks? And I said, yeah. I lived in Heartbreak Hotel then on the base. That's where they kicked out all the wives kicked their husbands out. They moved into this one. So he drove me back to the barracks. I remember when I got in his car, he says, get in the back. I got another guy to drop off. I looked to see if it had handles on the inside before I got in there. He drove me back to the barracks, and he says, you want to go to a meeting tonight? This was the 1 o'clock in the meeting at Pathfinder in the afternoon. And I says, yeah. I said, no. I says, I'm going to be busy. And he says, oh, if you change your mind, I'll be at First University, the Mission Hill group. I said, okay, but I'm going to be busy. I ain't going to go to a meeting. Yeah. As soon as he left, I was thinking, I ain't got nothing to do. I had 10 hours a day in a bar, you know, and I had a big vacuum there if I don't go in a bar, you know. So I think, what am I going to do? If I go to the club, I know I'm going to get drunk. I don't want to get drunk. So I caught the bus, and I went to First University. The bus was a dime in them days. You know, that's what you put in the basket to a dime, one bus fare. Yeah. And went to First University, and there was an old school they tore down since then and built another school there now. But this was one of these old high schools they had then. And you could tell where AA meeting was because there was only light on and smoke was coming out of every side. All the windows and doors, smoke. Everybody in AA smoked with both hands in them days. And I remember I went in the door, and just as I was entering the door, a hand reached out, shook my hand. It was Jim Burwell, the agnostic, the guy that gave us God as we understood him. I shook hands with him. He passed away many years ago, I don't know, at least 20. More than that, probably, I don't know, about 20 or so. But his wife Rosa was there. Rosa was our sheriff. She was about 5'2" with a pointed nose and a Philadelphia accent. And she had a way of talking. She'd make a gunnery sergeant stand at attention. If you look like you were going to break a tradition, you'd get a call from Rosa at 8 o'clock in the morning. We could sure use another Rosa. I looked around the room. I saw my sponsor there. I felt safe. Only known him an hour or so, you know. And then I looked around more, and I saw three good-looking young gals there. And I was thinking, lo and behold, we ain't dead yet. And when the meeting was over, my sponsor drove me back to the barracks again. And he gave me a big book to read. I read that big book all night. Till the alarm went off in the morning. The alarm went off. I put on my uniform, went to work. My captain noticed that I was sober one day in a row. And he wanted to know why. And I told him I joined Alcoholics Anonymous. He says, they're meeting today at 12, at 1 o'clock? I said, yeah. He says, take off at noon. He gave me every afternoon off for 90 days so I could make that 1 o'clock meeting. He didn't know I took it off anyway, but he gave me every afternoon off. And I made 180 meetings the first 90 days. Got real salty real quick. I went to a meeting on my 19th day. They said, Ski, would you like to say a few words? And I started off with, now for the benefit of the newcomer. I'd already been to 180 meetings. Salty. 19 days out, I had 38 meetings already, yeah. And anyway, that's how it all began. The time's going real fast, so I got to get to this. Anyway, I'm in AA. I went 4.5 years without a drink. I retired after about 1.5 years from the Marine Corps. That's because of the grace of God in the AA program, I got to retire as a gunnery sergeant. And then I went to work for the post office. And I worked there a while, and then they gave me a good job with a special delivery. And it was driving a station wagon and very little mail to handle. And I worked nights. I started that when I had a 3-year sobriety, and I had I worked nights for 1.5 years, and it got to me. I was working 6 days a week. It ruined my schedule. No social life and no meetings, you know. I just kept, and it was harder to go to meetings and harder, and even I'd miss Sunday, you know, when I could have went. And I started where I'd miss them even. And I wound up where, talking to myself, saying, nothing's happening to me, nothing good, nothing bad. I said, if nothing happens to me by Saturday, I'm going to make something happen. I'm going to get drunk. And I had all the symptoms that I needed. It was, you know, I was mad at all my friends for not calling me at midnight when I got off work. And I had resentments. I had fear and shaking, and all these things came back to me. I was moving. I turned myself around 180 degrees. Just you move 1 degree a day for 180 days, and you hardly notice that you moved. And you're thinking like you used to when you go 180 degrees. And that's the day I went out and I got drunk. I drank a fifth of whiskey sociably and came back. The next day I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous. I went to work. I went to work and I went in the office and told them I either got to go on days or quit. And I told them why. And they took me off of a special delivery and put me on a regular mailbag route. And it's funny, when I bid on a route downtown then, and central office moved right on my route, 2100 Ford, you know? And I was their mailman. So I was delivering the message to AA now, you know? And I used to put money in the meters for all the people that volunteered to work, you know? All the volunteers, I'd put money in the meters. If they had an Easy Does It sticker on a car, I'd feed the meters to keep from getting tickets. And anyway, I've been sober ever since then. That's February 5th was 43 years. Yeah. One of the greatest things that happened to me since I sobered up is that my brother called me in 1975. He says, hey, let's go to Czechoslovakia. And I said, Czechoslovakia? They're not going to let me in. I fought the communists in Korea. Now they're not going to let me in. It's a communist country, you know. And he says, well, don't tell them. You know, don't tell them you were in the Marine Corps, you know. So, I thought I couldn't afford it until I started remembering that that was my last payment on the Cadillac. And my child support ended that day, too. And I was going to be rich now, you know. All my money's going to be mine again, you know. So I said, I'll go. Let's put in for it. And I put in for it, and I wrote a memorandum application that said occupation. I put postal worker in big letters. They like that. And we got a 15-day visa. There was one guy in a directory. He was up in Prague, up in an area in north of Prague, anyway, and in the Czech Republic. And I wrote him a postcard, but he never answered. And it might be because he didn't want to correspond with somebody in the West, which would cause him to lose his job. He's a professor, and he'd end up being a janitor or something, you know, if he broke their rules, you know. So I couldn't communicate with anybody on AA. But I went in, and I found out the first 15 days we were there that I could have brought in a big book. Yeah, and you could bring in one Bible is what you could bring in, not a big book. But if I got caught with it, I'd say it was my Bible, you know. So I met a girl the first day. And she, we corresponded. And the second year, I went there for 5 weeks. And she was at the airport with a bouquet of flowers waiting for me, you know. And this went on for about 5 years like this. I was sneaking big books. I put one in each suitcase. And I'd leave them there. I'd give them to doctors and priests that could read English. You couldn't give them to the drunk that didn't. You know, they all speak Czech or Slovak, you know. And so I snuck in big books. Then I had to quit going for a couple of years because I married that girl. I brought her, I got her out of the Iron Curtain, miraculously. And I married the girl. And then she couldn't go back because she was supposed to go back to pay off her school, settle her things with the government. And she didn't go back. So she was like AWOL or something. And AWOL. And she stayed in the States. And they sentenced her a year in prison if she went back. But she didn't go back while it was communist. And the communist government got kicked out, and then it was all right for her to go home again. And we were married only going on 4 years. We got a divorce. We're still friends. She works for L.A. Times now. Yeah. She did for a long time now. Photographer. And anyway, the thing is that I started going like that. And in 1989, they kicked the communists out. It was no longer communist. In 1889, I came there and I gave a guy a big book, and he already had one translated in Czech. I got the original. I still got it at home. It's what it was, a green book instead of being blue. The following year, the AA started printing this book, and they made it in a blue bind, and, you know, like the other ones. So they made Czech books. And and the Slovaks could read them. And that went off all right. And so we started. Well, that in 1990, there were two meetings started in Prague. I was there with them when they were starting them. And the guy that started them was a guy that gave me this doctor's address in Slovakia. So when I got to Slovakia, I called this doctor up and told him, you know, I was on AA and I was interested in starting a group with him. And he says, "We're having a meeting today. 6 o'clock, and at the Mozart House." And my cousin took me down to the Mozart House, and they had about 4 people in a meeting. And that meeting is still exists now, and it's got like 30 people in it, all, you know, 30, 40. But they don't meet at the Mozart House anymore, and they call it the Mozart Group. And I said, "You can't call it you shouldn't call it the Mozart Group. Because we don't name groups after people." I said, "However, but you did name it that just because they started it in the Mozart House. So I think if you call it the Mozart House Group, you know, then you might get away with it that way, you know. Because we didn't name it after Mozart. We named it after his house." Yeah. So they still meet. They meet at the YMCA. If you're looking for it, you have to ask them. The IMCA, they say. The IMCA, it's at the IMCA, YMCA. And they meet on Monday at 6:30, yeah, in the IMCA, which is right near the railroad station. Now we must have about near 28 groups, I think, now in Slovakia. Czech Republic has about the same. We have conventions every year in both countries. The Slovaks are in about September, October, and the Czechs are in June. So I made almost all the Czech ones because they were in a better time of the year. But sometimes I go twice, and I'll make the Slovak and the Czech ones both. I've been to about 5 Czech conventions out of about 12, and it worked the other way around. I just made my 32nd trip there, and I go 5 weeks or 6 weeks average. Meeting, and we have AA is really established. I remember they used to talk about, the leader would say, "Any woes or joys?" And the woes always won, and we'd have a sad meeting. And something happens. I start trying to make him talk about something else, you know. I get him talking about the steps. And now you go in there now, they're talking about traditions and steps. And you swear you're in the States, only they weren't speaking English. And I speak Slovak. When I started, I spoke Slovak when I was a kid, but I forgot all of what I knew. And it was kid Slovak that I spoke then. So I couldn't hardly speak when I arrived the first time. And about 5 years ago, I spoke on the radio for 30 minutes about, told them all about Alcoholics Anonymous without giving them my name, you know, anonymously. And I spoke about 30 minutes. I had a couple, Larry and Gail. Larry and Gail went with me one time, and we spoke to a psychiatrist who couldn't speak English. And they were talking, and I was translating for them. As fast as the two of them were talking, I was translating. And I didn't think I could do it. And it came out real good. I know I had some help from upstairs, you know. I don't know why, but it was, I went, it just came out real easy. People say, are you nervous when you go to talk? I'm not nervous. Because before I come up, I turn it over to my higher power, and it's like putting it in cruise control. And it just goes, you know. You know, you just cruise. No hardship. But anybody interested in Slovakia or in the Czech Republic and they want information about it, I go out of my way. If you are from Yugoslavia, I have Slovenian books, and I have Czech books, and I have Slovak books in my car right now. If you like one, you're welcome to them, you know. And anybody wants to go to Slovakia, I'm willing to help you out. Yeah? Thank you.